Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 146 with Richard Wilson on leveraging to larger deals through family office investments. Richard Wilson is the founder of the Family Office Club, a network of family office representatives on one hand and a network of entrepreneurs and investment operators on the other hand. Family offices are organizations set up by wealthy families to manage their own wealth. They make investments in the real estate space in addition to their publicly traded equity portfolios and are always looking for qualified operators to run those investments. The size of family office investments range anywhere from a few hundred thousand up to tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. On today's episode, Richard and I discuss preparing yourself to attract investments from family offices, in addition to a few examples of recently closed investments. Let's get to it. All right, Richard, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
Doing well. So I am in Chicago recording. We actually have pretty nice weather here. November, December, it's usually a little bit colder than it is this week. But whereabouts are you recording from, and how is your day there looking so far?
Yeah, I'm in Key Biscayne, Dan. I'm just about 10 minutes from downtown Miami. And like usual, it's about 80 degrees here, so can't complain about the weather. I know how Chicago can get. It was negative 30 degrees when we hosted an event there in February earlier this year. So I hope you guys don't get that low again this year.
Yeah, it probably will. I live right on the lake. I can look out the window and I see the lake freeze over completely when it gets cold like that, which is really cool to look at. But you know, it's cold out there when that happens. So, cool. So, Richard, for listeners who don't know about Family Office Club and who Richard Wilson is, why don't you give a backstory, Reader's Digest version about maybe how you got into the business and what your business looks like today?
Sure. I'll give the real quick version, and then you can always ask me questions about anything you think your listeners actually care to hear more about. So I was raising capital, figured out institutional investors were too big, and high net worth investors were too small and not accredited sometimes. So I knew I had to go somewhere in between, stumbled upon wealth advisory firms that focused on the ultra wealthy called family offices. I figured out I should only be raising capital from them. But when I decided to do that, I found that was almost impossible because there weren't many that had websites back in 2007. There were no trail guides or experts, very few books on the industry at all. So I just started posting online what I was learning. And since no one else was doing so, I got 100 hits a day, 1,000 hits a day, got on the front page of the Boston Globe. I bought familyoffices.com over a decade ago, spoke 100 times in 14 countries at different conferences, and started hosting our own conferences. And, fast forward a decade and we've hosted 130 live events and published 4 books on the industry and put out a lot of video and media content. And we're really a media company in the center of it all with our live events and videos, YouTube, et cetera. And then on the left-hand side, we help people who raise capital, not as a placement agent, because there's 1,000 people doing that, but we help in terms of having our investor databases and directories and with our pitchdecks.com investor relations marketing agency. And on the right-hand side of the platform, we help investors, and we help them on a performance fee-only basis allocate to the best of the best investments that we see come through the Family Office Club. And so we're really representing the investors in transactions that sourcing those deals through the conferences. So it's a little bit of a unique model like that. Most people are a conference provider or a deal broker, and that's kind of what they do, that one thing. And we kind of have more of a platform approach.
Yeah, it makes sense. So I'm going to see if I summarize it just to make sure I don't have any holes in everything that you mentioned so far. On one hand, you have this database and a ton of experience raising capital with family offices, who are like kind of a niche, middle region, well-capitalized source to fund deals. And so you're adding value to that constituency by hosting the conferences for people who are potentially generating deals and want to utilize the capital of the family offices. And you're adding value to that constituency as well, because you're kind of being able to like matchmake. And you're also able to, I guess, filter some of these deals. And I'm sure you've seen a ton of them. So you're having a pretty decent success rate with placing and making the connection between family office and certain operators in the marketplace. Did I miss any constituencies there? Anybody else?
No, that's right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, some people hear all that and they're like, oh, how confusing. I don't really get what business are you really in. But the other way to look at it is we are more valuable to investors because we have 6,500 people coming through our events each year. So we see a ton of deal flow, a ton of ideas, 200 family offices speak at our events. That makes us smarter and more well-connected for our investors, but also we're more valuable to the people raising capital because we're texting, emailing, and calling these ultra-wealthy investors every day about their investments. Mm-hmm. So it serves both sides that we do both. I know we're not a common business model, but it's been working out well.
No, it's interesting. And I had a friend years ago, 2006, 2007, it's when I first started flipping houses. We've done plenty since then. I think this year to date, we've made $4 million from 179 deals closed, and we've got just about 100 in our pipeline as we speak. So we've been really blessed, and we don't have at my company, we have high net worth investors, accredited investors who fund some of our deals. We do a lot of self-funding of deals, some lines of credit associated with, you know, some of the big investment banks if we need them. But capital hasn't really been one of the constraints for us to grow Diamond Equity Investments, Richard. But I know there's a lot of people whose business model is a little bit different. So if you're, you know, multifamily, venture capital, starting businesses, buying businesses, there's a lot of higher need for capital than what I might have in my business. And I think that for those kind of investors who are focused on that and who are needing someone like yourself, I mean, I'm just going to go out on a limb here. Would you say that you would add value if an operator was listening right now and brought a specific type of deal that you would know in that entire Rolodex of however many family offices you've dealt with who might have more of an appetite for a certain type of deal, and like how much of an uphill battle it might be for that operator to go out and like cold call family offices, if you will, as opposed to bringing the deal to someone who's a little bit more connected and knows what these offices are looking for? Is that a challenge for people?
Yeah, that's part of the value. But also what a lot of people don't get when they first come to our network, to the Family Office Club, they often say, okay, Richard, well, help me get in front of three investors. You know, I'm pretty good at closing. Just get me in front of 10. I'll close half of them. And it kind of misses the point a little bit. It's like going to somebody who's a master fisherman of a certain type of fish and saying, hey, can you get me two fish of this type? Can you get me two salmon? But really, if that master fisherman can teach you how to fish and how they attract investors, then you could attract two fish every day or every week or every month. And so we have interactions with investors at our 9 investor summits per year. But we also teach workshops. We write the books. We have a book that's free at capitalraising.com, and it's just a 1-hour read on the steps you can take to raise capital more effectively. And many times people send us their deal, and we kind of have to back up a little bit and say, well, first of all, I don't really understand everything about your deal the way you've presented it. Second of all, you have a clip art logo or no logo and no website, and the name of your company is, you know, XYZ Capital or some Greek god that people don't know what it means unless they look it up, and no one ever does. And there's just so many things going on that make it so that the deal is almost irrelevant, because when investors, you know, allocate at a big level, what's most important is high conviction, trust in the team and the strategy. And the returns are less important, even though they want the returns to be there, but it's the credibility and long-term commitment and the excellence at the team and the strategy level that matters more than anything else. So if that all gets messed up in the communication, we kind of need people to take a step back and try to help them at a deeper level rather than just trying to like broker a quick deal and have them move on their way.
Yeah, it sounds like you've probably seen people who brought that deal with very lackluster low quality packaging, not necessarily the amount of intelligent thought and time invested, as you might see in a deal that attracted the fish every other day. In other words, got the funding and actually closed. You've seen people bumble through all that stuff, and that's what it sounds like a lot of the workshops and, hey, here, package this and present this that way. And then the next thing you know, you've kind of thought through the idea and the business model at a level that it was worth a family office or someone else taking the financial risk and investing in the deal, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like, most people can't say in a single sentence why their firm is unique and powerful and, you know, why they matter on planet Earth to an investor who's never heard from them before. You know, the fact that you or somebody buys B or C grade apartments and renovates them at $10K a door and then raises the rents, you know, there's 600 people in the U.S., 600 different investment firms in the U.S. alone that I know of that do that. And so drilling down to what really makes you unique and what's your unique focus and value add and getting that down to one line that you can use in voicemail and email, et cetera, you know, is something most people don't bother to do. So it's just one example of about 30 different things that most people don't bother to do when they're in their first decade of raising capital, but almost everybody does who's really effective at raising capital.
So let's talk about a couple of the deals that have gotten funded, I don't know, recently. Can you talk about maybe some of the details, whether it's a business model, whether it was a certain marketing plan that was put together, maybe the size of the deal, if that's something you're able to share, just to paint a picture of the type of deals perhaps that are the caliber that a family office is looking for and actually has funded in your own observation?
Yeah, sure. So three quick examples would be: one is an inefficient life settlement investment that one of my clients was allocated to and two other clients are under due diligence on, and just an inefficient investment space that produces a good return. And because it's not correlated with real estate or the stock market in general, you know, it's attractive to families. It's also a consistent, good-sized team behind it. Another example is a debt platform, where basically the investor gets a debt payment back and they're getting a 12% debt note return basically, with collateral behind it. And the dividend payments come out monthly, and investors like stuff that pays out, you know, monthly or quarterly and has good collateral behind it. I think that's a common trend I see with many families. And the third one is a really small size deal, but it was a operating business investment where there is a gross revenue royalty structure for the investor. So they're getting 1.5% gross revenue royalty on all the revenue coming in to the company. And then they have equity warrants at the time of the exit for the company. And so they're basically getting their money back off the table quicker than they usually would in the business. And they've got a, you know, an equity component that gets activated when the business gets sold eventually at some point. So with each of those three, there's something unique about it from the average company. And we work with a lot of, about half of our clients. We have about 56 clients within our investor relations marketing agency, and about half of those are real estate groups. And it's a real challenge sometimes for real estate groups to identify what makes them unique from all the other ones that do very similar work to them. But I think it's important to dig into.
So let's talk about the three that you just mentioned. The inefficient life insurance settlement market. We don't have to dive into the details of the business model or how the investment works, but just give us an idea, like, what was the investment from the office on that deal? Are you allowed to share that?
Yeah. No, I'm happy to share. So on the first one, it was $500,000 allocation, and it's by an entrepreneur who's making, you know, seven figures profit a year in the business, is a relatively young person and just wanted diversification. The second investment is going to be for a seven figure amount. It probably just be $1 million flat from a, family client of ours that is just sitting on too much cash and looking to put it to work. So, you know, they're wanting to allocate relatively quickly, but we're afraid of, you know, allocating to the wrong ideas or something that was going to be too correlated with the rest of their portfolio.
And what was the collateral on that? That was the debt platform investment, right?
Yeah, the debt platform investment is actually a company that does $75 million a year in EBITDA, or profits, basically. And what they've been doing is just paying out this these debt payments, these income payments to investors every month, and they've never missed a month in doing so. And whenever we hear something that no one else has said they're doing after, you know, running our platform for 12 years, and it seems highly aligned with investors or different but unique in a way where we know investors have requested things like that, then that stands out to us. And I think that's one of the most important points when people are trying to figure out what to offer to investors. And they want to invest in things that are anomalies. They don't want to invest in something that looks average. And the investors who are smart but not well connected realize that the few deals they see are probably not anomalies. If you're only seeing 5 or 10 or 20 deals a year, what are the chances that one is a top 1% type deal? Not very good. But if you're seeing a ton of deal flow, then, you know, you can start to pick out what's the superior structure, superior team, et cetera. So it's really, you know, how do you look at everything you do as an investment firm and think, okay, well, our most unique or valuable work is this one thing that we do. And hopefully it's something that also produces some of your best returns, and maybe focusing only on that or leading with that in a conversation is what's going to help things go forward better.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, from my own experience doing, you know, the number of deals I mentioned a little bit earlier, it's, I don't know, we see 12,000 leads come across our desk to do the, you know, few mm-hmm. hundred deals that we do. And it's the same kind of thing in 2006 when I got in the business. It was like, you know, oh my gosh, there's like a house for sale. So totally makes sense to be able to kind of sift and sort and have that volume of deal flow coming through the gates there to take a look at. The operating business, 1.5% of gross revenues. It sounds like a pretty good deal right there, depending on what the business model was. What was the capital on that allocation? Just out of curiosity.
That allocation was the smallest one that we have done with one of our investors. That this operating business is just doing a $300,000 round, and this investor took half of it. So they invested $150,000 of the $300,000, and that wire transfer just went through a couple of days ago. And so I would say that's probably the smallest that most of these family offices go is $100,000. And even this family who allocated that $150,000, they're really trying to do $250,000 and $500,000 per investment. It was just in this case, they wanted to only be taking half the round and not the whole round, just to diversify a bit more.
And in your experience, since the same 2006-07, you were raising capital before. Maybe it would help to share what was the capital raises that you were doing. Were they real estate related or like brokering of capital that led you into the business? And then I'll have a follow-up question to that.
Yeah, those were, one was a hedge fund. It was a capital raising mandate for a $30 million in assets under management hedge fund manager. We also had a multi-billion dollar long only optimization investment firm that built kind of SMA models and UMA models. And then we had another separate managed account clients as well. So, you know, our model was to charge a retainer $10,000 a month per client, plus get a percentage of, you know, a fee on the capital raised.
So in all of that experience, what have been the average size of deals that people would present? Maybe not across the board with all the experience, but to the family offices that you're servicing currently, what's the average size of the deal? Is it in that 250 to 500 range? Are you talking total capital raise of, you know, 7 million using 5 million in debt from regular banks and 2 million in capital from the family offices? What do the debt structures look like? To qualify,
yeah,
make it worth
times,
their time.
Yeah, many times their goal is to be allocating $500,000 or $1 million as a bare minimum. But I will say that sometimes if they're not sure about the size of the manager or they really feel like they need to get to know them more, they might just put $100,000 into a deal just to get to know them and see how they're treated. But their real goal is to put $500,000 to $1 million to work within each relationship. I think that when a family gets to $100 million or higher, then that number obviously goes up. And for most allocations, they're going to be looking to put $1.5 to $3 million to work because they might not want more than, you know, 15 to 30 different investments at any one time.
Yeah, it makes sense after you reach a certain amount of, I'm sure the listeners on the show who are dealing with houses going through the same thing that I'm going through where, you know, 10, 12, 14 different single family houses, all of a sudden you see the value in buying, you know, $1 million, $1.5 million single commercial properties because it's a lot less paperwork. So I guess that same leap would go if someone was trying to put $100 million in capital to work. So before we started our call here today, Richard, you'd mentioned the centimillionaire trend, and we didn't dive into that at all. So would you mind enlightening me and all the REI Diamond Show listeners?
Yeah, sure. So Centimillionaire Advisors is the work we do, setting up family offices for ultra-wealthy families, you know, starting at 10, 15, 20 million net worth. A lot of our clients are 50, $100 million plus. Net worth, over half of them are 100 million plus. And the word centimillionaire means 100 million plus net worth. You know, everyone knows the word billionaire means $1 billion plus. So I think that's important to note. And what we've found is that most people who help others set up a family office and get great access to deal flow are charging a couple $100,000 a year for consulting fees or a flat assets under management fee. So what we did was looked at the family office industry and said, well, if you were to hire someone to run your family office, you'd have to pay them a multiple six-figure fee, and then usually give them a little bit of carry on the deals they help you with. So in our case, we help set up family offices. We charge nothing for that, no consulting fees, no assets under management fees, and we only charge a performance fee on the deals that they allocate to that we brought to the table for them. So in other words, we'll give them the advice and the help to earn their trust and get to know them really well. And by getting to know them well, we know what their deal strike zone is, and we'll bring them those real estate and operating investments that meet their criteria because we help them define that criteria. And then we just charge them a 5 to 10% performance fee on those deals.
And that comes out of the family office's share. That performance fee, is that 5 to 10% of the total allocation or 5% to 10% of the upside?
Of the upside. So typically a common arrangement is 5% of the cash flows or distributions and then 10% of the net exit gain. So when they leave the fund or exit the investment, it's 10% performance fee on that. But if they do 3 to 5 investments through us and say one loses money, we don't get any additional distribution or net exit gain fees until we've recouped their losses. So it kind of aligns us over the medium to long term, especially if they do multiple investments through us, because then they pay no fee if we haven't made them money.
Sounds like a good arrangement. At what point does a family, an entrepreneur, you know, all of a sudden they find themselves, they sold a business? I mean, what is the dollar amount where somebody should say, you know what, this is worth kind of like putting together the family office and organizing that, even if they haven't reached, I assume, $100 million yet? Is there a point where that starts to make it worth the effort and time?
Yeah, so what I found pretty consistently, maybe starting at $10 million, but really more so at $15 million, $20 million net worth, investors want to start doing more direct investments. They want to start getting access to better real estate investments, the passive, you know, income investments where they're allocating as an LP perhaps, or lending investments. And the closer they get to $50 million, the more likely it is that they're doing that. And really, when you get to $30 or $50 million, you know, 80 or 90% of investors I know are wanting to do those other types of investments in addition to what they have in the stock market. And when you get to $100 million net worth, you're paying for a family office whether you have one or not, because you're making mistakes, you're not being as focused as you could be, you're not being as effective, not being as tax efficient. So you're really paying for one and just not getting the benefits of it if you're worth $100 million or anywhere close to that and you don't have family office level solutions in place.
Maybe you could help me define it. I'm taking these notes and asking these questions, and I realize, okay, what exactly is a family office? Is it just an office and you got a handful of people there? Are there, you know, people like yourself who are setting up? I mean, what does it look like once a person has set up or a family has actually set up one of these offices?
Sure. Yeah. So sometimes a lean version of it would be just 2 to 4 employees. Sometimes just 1 to 3 employees who are running a single family office They can have a dozen or even up to 100 employees, but it changes drastically if they have an operating business and they really have a powerful CFO in that operating business who's helping them acquire assets. Then a lot of the employees who would be inside of a family office kind of setup team are really being pushed down inside of the operating business. So I think that's important to know. Also, there's something called a multifamily office, which is managing wealth for many different families that are ultra wealthy. It could be 5, 10, 30 different families plus. And the last term that people should know is the virtual family office. So about half of all family offices don't have a formal office place, don't have a formal investment committee. They have one person or one part-time person that's helping manage all of the affairs. And then they just get family office quality outsourcing partners to have a lot of the benefits of a family office, but not all of the infrastructure and overhead. So this is, you know, most appropriate for families that are under 50 million or under 100 million net worth. And, but once you get to 250, 300 million, you typically need a full-time dedicated, team that, involves multiple professionals focused on just helping you.
And is that something that you were talking about when you set up the family office for somebody? These are the professionals that you've already vetted. This is your team. I mean, what does that structure look like?
Yeah, so typically there's a CEO of the family office that could be the principal, or it could be a hired gun CEO. Many times they're hired from other single family office firms or a big private equity type group in the industry if they're going to be doing lots of acquisitions. There's then usually a CIO, a chief investment officer. There almost always is a CIO if the principal is the one acting as the CEO. Then there's usually an analyst or portfolio manager. Sometimes there's also someone helping with due diligence on the accounting side. So there could be a CFO. If the team is large enough, the numbers are large enough, they need that level of quality of help. But many times there's just a controller in place if maybe they want someone that's more mid-level on the accounting, financial modeling side. So the type of due diligence needed is going to drastically change the look of the team and the size of the team and what job titles you're going to have there. And I think that, you know, sometimes people want to hire only people that have family office industry experience, and others just go for as long as they have industry experience in the area they're going to be investing in most, then they're fine with just that. So it's two different kind of mindsets on how to build out the team.
Are these typically like a life event driven creating the family office, or is it, you know, like what's the avatar client? Are we talking about the principal has created a business? Maybe they're at it 20, 25 years. They're making a lot of cash, or is it typically, you know, the sale of a business then triggers the family office creation to administer and invest the wealth from that recent sale, or some combination thereof, or generational wealth, or, you know, like what's the background a little bit?
Sure. There's three types of clients that we've been serving. So the first type that's most common is that they've sold to private equity or they've sold their business completely and they've had a massive liquidity event. Like one of my clients sold his company for $1 billion and he's worth $300 million. Another client sold his business for $340 million and he owned 100% of it. Another one that's smaller sold their business for, you know, $20 million. So sudden increase in wealth. I then have a couple other, another type of client that's a heavy seven-figure earner. So, two examples is one that's earning $4.5 million a year. Another's earning $9 million a year. They're both sitting on a lot of cash and they're anxious about that. And they know they should be smarter and they're just busy running their business. So they've neglected doing anything with their capital. And that's why they reach out trying to figure out what they should be doing and how to set up a family office. And then the third type is really, maybe not at that big of a level. They're not making $9 million a year, perhaps. And then maybe they didn't sell a business for $100 million. But we've been working with more medical professionals and doctors and surgeons specifically, and we've had enough traction there that we've actually set up a portal and like a little sub community within the family office club for surgeons to connect with each other. And these are individuals that might be a W-2 employee making $1.2 or $1.6 million a year. They may not own their own surgical practice yet, or they may. And when they do, they earn even more. But those are steady earners who are very busy working, and they need family office level help, but they're not at the $50 or the $100 million level. And I think that many times people in the family office industry say, oh, well, every family office is different. And I don't really think that's true or helpful. If you are a first-generation family who sold your manufacturing business for over $100 million, you have a lot in common with other families like that. And if you are a cosmetic surgeon making $1.5 million a year in Texas and you do not own your own practice, you have a lot in common with other people who are in that similar situation. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, finding those commonalities and the best practices and the models of what's going to help certain classes and types of family offices best.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the $4.5, $9 million a year earner focusing on running their business. I just look at my own past, and it's like I probably distracted myself a little bit as we were scaling by trying to, like, invest the money as it comes in for that same reason that they're, like, they're in a much better position to, like, have the cash have piled up already and then, like, oh, gosh, I better responsibly put this somewhere so that I am at least beating inflation, and ideally this is actually growing the capital. But I think there's something to be said for intense focus on the main business, the main cash generation machine that I think a lot of real estate investors – can take a lesson from, you know, that like red hot pointed laser focus running of the business, as opposed to, you know, the first time any amount of capital comes in, all of a sudden now we've taken off our entrepreneur hat and we're like running around trying to invest that capital. So I digress. At what point in dollar amount ready to invest would it make sense for a family office to maybe like create their own private bank? If that would make sense, is that an option for some families?
Yeah, I mean, some act like a bank to real estate, you know, like a hard money lender type investor. I've got a client who's done 150 hard money loans, for example, and they love real estate backed lending opportunities, and they like to see stuff at a 60% LTV, and they'll do small deals. You know, I was on a call with one group. They buy houses in Indiana for $25,000 and renovate them for $25,000. And, you know, I didn't know there was houses in America for sale for $25,000 except for in Detroit. But they'll do things that low all the way up to, you know, a couple million-dollar piece of real estate that's commercial that they could underwrite appropriately. So I think that in that way, they're acting a little bit like a bank in terms of, you know, conducting, you know, loan underwriting work. But, you know, I have other clients that have bought banks before. So I think that's another way to approach it. But most of them don't call their internal investments a bank. The only other mention I see of that is for managing the next generational wealth transfer. They could create a family bank, which would be an informal bank with some rules around it so that the next generation only gets money for education, their first house, a medical emergency, and then they only get additional capital if they want to buy a business or start a business that is approved by the elders in the family. And that's how they get to inherit money, by adding value to society and having a fulfilling, challenging environment where you're learning how to grow a business, and that instills entrepreneurism into the next generation instead of cocaine and laziness, you know, potentially by just giving your kids $10 million when they turn 18 and say, have fun in Monaco, you know, good luck, right? So I think that it depends on what values the family wants to put forward. But those are the different types of bank type situations I've had come up with my clients.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up an entirely different tangent I'm sure we could talk about for hours, but like, wow, the burden of, or responsibility or opportunity, depending on, you know, who's viewing that event. But I'm sure some people are so focused on, you know, creating the wealth, generating wealth, there's not a minute to look up and then decide things, just like you mentioned there, where they're constructing foresight and thought for the future to hopefully have generations that perhaps aren't even of majority age yet, to be encouraged to add to society, start a business, you know, grind, get up, build something. I mean, there's just such, satisfaction and gratitude that I know I have in my own life, having watched the transformation for me, you know, as our business has grown and I hope continues to grow. And man, like, I just hope that I'm able to see other people and maybe even my own daughter and other family go through maybe that same satisfaction of putting something together, seeing it come to fruition, knowing all of the value that we're adding to society as opposed to inheriting the money and heading to Monaco and all the other stuff you mentioned there. Are there any questions? Because this entire topic here, it's way outside my own depth, Richard. I appreciate you taking the time to have the conversation here with me. Since capital hasn't been a restrictor for me, this is not something I've had to dedicate a lot of time to, but I know that in real estate, in larger scale real estate deals, there's a lot greater need for capital than we have here. Two things. One, if you could just kind of give me like a, and it doesn't have to be exact, this is not the census, I'm not the U.S. Census Bureau, but like a, hey, I've seen like 30% of these deals are real estate deals, I've seen, you know, 10% of this kind. Are there like percentages or a majority of a certain type of deal that you see coming through and getting funded, at least in your own experience?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've seen that deals that people can understand and get done, and deals where there's a trust built because they're either local to the asset, they've already invested in that industry before, or it's an industry where they work in it all day long. Or they've known the team for a very long time. Those are the types of deals that get done. If they can't understand the investment process or how the industry works, you're in trouble. That means they have to really trust the team a lot or be local to the deals. They can go to it several times and meet in person a lot, et cetera. And the more you can have these elements in place, the better things go. So if you're raising capital for a commercial real estate deal and you can do so by going to commercial real estate brokers or investors who invest in commercial real estate all the time, yet still can meet their higher hurdle of what's a unique, valuable deal that's unique, but they can still understand it and it's unique value, but it doesn't confuse them, then that's kind of the magic where you can get a deal done relatively quickly versus if you imagine going to raise capital from people that don't know you and you're raising capital from investors in Singapore for a deal in San Diego, and you're raising capital from biotech healthcare investors, and it's a real estate deal, and it's not an easy to understand type of real estate deal. It's like a data warehouse or some sort of industrial real estate that people might not be as familiar with as self-storage or multifamily, then it's a real uphill battle. And it can be a waste of everyone's time to go into such meetings. So, you know, the more you can get, you know, higher up that trust, those trust curves, going into the meetings, the better things go for you if you're raising capital.
Would you say that the split is like 50% real estate related, 50% business and other related?
That's a good question. So basically, I see what you're meaning now with the question. So basically, an average ultra wealthy family that I work with is going to put a certain percentage into the stock market with their traditional wealth manager or multifamily office. And that percentage could be anywhere from 30 to 60% of their net worth, you know, on average. It just depends on the family's needs and risk and income needs. But, and if we take that percentage to the side and we say, okay, well, that's their wealth management diversification allocation. If we put that to the side and we look at the remaining balance of their capital, then typically about half, and a little bit more than half typically of that remaining balance would go into cash flowing real estate, and the remaining balance of their portfolio would go into operating businesses. So overall, when we surveyed 180 family offices, we found that 78% of them had a strategic allocation to real estate. And when they did, they would allocate around 28% of their portfolio to real estate investments. So it's going to be different based on different families and where we are in the economic cycle, but those are some of the high level numbers.
Yeah, I think that's helpful and instructive. I mean, that's almost what my own allocation is in percentages. I think it's very important, and I think a lot of real estate investors who listen to my show would probably have had the type of mindset toward the stock market like I used to have a while back. And that was, oh no, it's horrible. You're going to lose money there. But keeping a portion of, you know, your wealth available in something that's marketable securities and relatively liquid, I think is like very important. And I think it's helped my own perspective on the real estate assets that I decide to hold long term, having gone through the process of, you know, not only the emotional, but the intellectual exercise of researching and taking a look at the stocks that I actually own and knowing why I own those has helped me to better answer my own questions as an investor when it comes to the real estate that I own of, you know, how did I select those? Did I feel like they were a good idea compared to the intrinsic value of them? You know, why am I holding these? Why do I believe that these houses are going to go up in value? Do I think these are going to go up in value? Is there some other reason that I'm holding these? And I think that that allocation percentage that you shared was pretty solid and pretty accurate. So are there any questions I forgot or didn't know to ask that you think the audience might gain benefit from, Richard, as we wrap up here?
Sure. Well, I know a lot of your audience might have deals they're raising capital for and things they're trying to syndicate. So I think one of the most important things to stress is that it becomes more credible and more appealing and people lean forward more when they can understand what your laser focus is and why you're superior at that. So if you go to a meeting and you say, oh, I'm a commercial real estate deal maker, or you know, I invest in apartment buildings, and someone asks, oh, well, what area do you do that in? And you say, oh, well, all over, you know, all over the United States, and you have a two-person team or a four-person team, it's night and day different than saying, the only thing we do is buy self-storage in San Diego, and we've identified the 92 assets in that area, and we have a database of them, and we work that database every quarter to meet with them to see who needs to sell quickly because of a divorce or a death, who needs to move something off their balance sheet at a decent price, and they know that we can close because all we do is self-storage in San Diego. And then it's believable that with even a four-person team, you probably know self-storage San Diego pretty damn well compared to the average guy who's doing, or the average team that's doing many types of deals in many cities or regions. And so it doesn't have to be a tight geographical and asset focus, but whatever you have, it should be able to be so focused and unique but believable and credible that as soon as someone hears it, they're like, oh, okay, well, I'm not investing in that, but I should introduce you to my friend because even though I haven't invested with you, I get what you do. I see how you add value, and you should talk to John here because he's looking for something like that, and that can get you a referral before somebody's even invested with you.
Yeah, I think that is instructive to, first of all, the example with the self-storage. The description is evidence of a deep dive of knowledge of the marketplace or the business model that they're operating on. I know from my own experience, you know, I've been in 7 markets around the United States. I'm in 3 markets and I've gone very deep. And so has my team. We know these markets. We operate in these markets. We know, you know, block by block, there's certain, you know, places I'd recognize immediately, the 100 block, and get excited about certain deals. I would assume that when I talk that way to my investors, that's something that would put them at ease, but that depth, I recognize the depth of detail as being, an example of a person's experience, because I know that I've gone that deep on my own business and continue to find gold by going that deep on my own business. And so I would look at my own books and my own consistency over the past couple of years and know that I was confident enough that I will take an outside investor's money because I know I'm going to pay them back 100% of the time with the interest, just like I promised them 100% of the time. So if somebody else can talk the way that I think about my own business, I think you hit the nail right on the head. Richard, are there any books that you would recommend, maybe related to the family office topic here, maybe just business or real estate or other investment books that you feel like would be a good recommendation?
Sure. Yeah. One of my favorites is called Success Principles by Jack Canfield. And I read that book every year. And every year I make some little notes in it. And because he's providing you with principles on being more successful, you can interpret them and use them differently every year. It's not like just telling you some advice that might get outdated, but that once you know it, now you don't need to read it again. So I think that's one of my favorite books to recommend.
Nice. And if you could go back, you know, 2006, 2007, there's no information on the internet about family office investments and the type of capital raising that you've been doing. But if you could go back, it's 2019 now, so like 10, 12 years, and you could share with yourself the crown jewel of wisdom, what would that be?
I think it's to fire faster, you know, and hold more accountability within the team. So many times would have an employee that was just not excellent and they were okay. And by putting up with that, it really slowed our growth early on. And then once we got excellent people in place and looked at them as kind of investments in our own business, then it dramatically changed everything. And we were able to grow much faster. And, you know, I just wish that earlier on, I just, you know, got out of things that were not working faster, you know, in the business, whether it's an employee or a partnership, and just be, you know, more cut and dry about it when you know it's not working.
Yeah, I think that is, that's very good advice. It's very good advice, very difficult when you're in that position to, you know, jettison the dead weight. But hey, the ship's not going to go at the speed that it can go unless we get the right crew on board. So I think that's spot on. So if anybody wants to get some more information about you, do you have a website or other contact information you'd like to share?
Yeah, sure. So our 30 events a year are listed at familyoffices.com. There's membership details there, a free book on family offices, and then, you know, anyone that'd like to get our free book on capital raising, that can be found at capitalraising.com as well.
All right. Richard, I appreciate you closing the door, blocking out the distractions. I got a ton of notes here. Very interesting topic, unique to our show. I'm sure the listeners are nodding their head in approval as well in gratitude. So thank you for coming on the show.
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me on here, Dan. Appreciate it.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Coming up on the next episode, marketing meetups and department syndication with Adam Adams. Adam and I discuss some behind-the-scenes hacks and strategies that we have actually both used to supercharge our own respective businesses. If you're interested in hearing the truth about how it's done, you'll want to keep an ear out and your notepad ready. We shall not disappoint. Dealmakers, I have cash for you. If you've got a deal, I buy houses and apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia. It's a 2-hour drive from any of those downtown cities. So if you have a deal in that range there, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Are you an accredited investor who is interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. We've reached the end. Dan Breslin, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.